Hi, I'm Jenny.
And I'm Scott.
Welcome to episode 9 of the Reading Envy podcast.
Where we'll have what you're reading. I guess I got to the pub a little early today.
I guess so.
Well, we're back, folks. We had a short hiatus. I was gone for work and Jenny was gone visiting family, but we're back. And our new format, we're going to do this every 2 weeks.
We hope you like us.
Yeah.
Because you'll get more of us.
You bet. So, well, let's jump right on into it then.
Yeah, sure.
You're first. What have you got? What have you been reading?
Well, I had this goal for myself this year to read some books on depression. I really wanted to understand depression better, both as a supervisor and as a friend. And so I had read some books that I had found, and then a friend found out I was doing this, and he is someone who has struggled with depression his whole life and recommended this book to me called The Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression by Andrew Solomon. I don't think I would typically talk about nonfiction, but this book is really incredible. First of all, there are sections on depression, breakdowns, treatments, alternatives, populations, addiction, suicide, history, poverty, politics, the evolution of the disease, and hope. And it kind of sounds like it would be a super scientific text, but it's just so beautifully written. And it's very dense. It took me months to read. I wasn't reading it continuously over that time, but I could only read at most 10 pages at a time. It was just so much to take in. The author, Andrew Solomon, he has suffered from depression, has had several breakdowns, and has gone through myriad numbers of treatments. And so he kind of weaves his own story in, along with a lot of really contemporary research and information on treatments, as well as stories from other people that he interviewed, some people with their real names, some people not. I just felt like I ended the book with a much greater understanding of all the intricacies, all the struggles, and also what people who are outside of the disease can do. So I have a few pieces I was going to read from it just to give you an example.
Cool.
This is from near the end. The survivors stay on pills, waiting. We go on. You cannot choose whether you get depressed, and you cannot choose when or how you get better, but you can choose what to do with the depression, especially when you come out of it. The survivors stay on pills, waiting. I liked that. He talks a lot about how you find a treatment that works, and then it stops working for no apparent reason. You have to go through all of it again, and how that can be such a drain. Let's see what else I wanted to read. He talks about grief and how it leads to depression and different times of day. Like, there's this one little piece that really had an impact on me as thinking of it from a supervisor perspective. Almost all people who suffer from depression feel worse in the morning and better as the day goes on. So just thinking about, you know, extending flexibility to people who may need to come in later every once in a while. Wow. You know, just little things like that. I mean, I was applying it to that directly, but even just knowing, well, what do I do as a friend if someone withdraws completely because they're going through one of the dark periods in depression? You know, can I do anything? Should I leave them alone? Do I need to be more present? Well, these are questions I'm always asking.
Yeah, what kind of answers were you given from the book?
Well, it was clear, at least for him, that having people in his life that wouldn't let him isolate completely, whether or not he wanted to be around them, was really essential for his survival. And also, I guess, understanding that people are going through those things and not getting impatient and frustrated as, you know, much as humanly possible. Patience, I think, seemed most important. Not abandoning a friend because they go through these kinds of things and not taking it personally. That's not an easy thing.
Yeah. Especially if somebody doesn't know somebody else very well at all. You know, they're chances yeah. are them just walking away are pretty high, probably.
They are, yeah. Mm. And this is a real struggle of a disease to live with. It never goes away.
Yeah.
But man, this book, it's probably the most beautiful capture of it that, you know, I could have read. And I really, I've been recommending it to a lot of people. But I always tell them, give yourself a year. You know, you don't want to read it all in one sitting, for sure.
Wow.
And, you know, to let it really sink in. I mean, I ended up even taking the several months that I did, I found myself skimming near the end. Hmm. I mean, especially when it's talking about alternative treatments and, you know.
Wow. He wrote a book called Far From the Tree, mm-hmm. Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. It's also very highly rated.
I've heard that one's really good, too.
Nice. Yeah. And then he's got a novel called A Stone Boat.
Hmm.
I assume it's the same Andrew Solomon.
Yeah, because he does make his living as a writer.
Mm.
So that makes sense to me. I mean, his writing is so beautiful, just writing about depression, that I think I would like to try the novel.
Well, cool. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess that's all I have to say about it.
Yeah, I highly recommend it, though. Okay. Yeah, that's something that I think I ought to read as well. It's about 500-something pages, it looks like. Almost 600.
Yes, of very dense, small type.
Very dense, small type, and yes. 600 pages.
Woo!
But valuable.
Very.
Very valuable. Okay.
Yeah. So how about you?
Well, mine's probably not as valuable, this first one. But I really enjoyed it. what I wanted to talk about is On Stranger Tides by Tim Powers.
Hmm.
Now, I know you've read a little bit of Tim Powers.
A little bit.
Yeah,
one book.
One book. Well, this book, On Stranger Tides, may sound familiar because Pirates of the Caribbean number 4 was called On Stranger Tides. Mm. And this is a pirate novel. But this came out, you know, long before the Pirates of the Caribbean movies. Mm. This was 1988. And a lot of people in the genre reading community thought that Tim Powers ought to be suing Disney immediately after the very first one, because it was like, you know, elements of this book were kind of scattered throughout all the Pirates of the Caribbean movies. And they ended up, Disney ended up optioning the novel right before they made the fourth one, which they called On Stranger Tides, but again, really had almost nothing to do with the novel, other than the Fountain of Youth was in it. So, anyway, I think that's interesting. But Tim Powers, the book, first of all, the book is about this guy. His name is John Shandagnac. I don't know what kind of a name that is. He's headed to the New World because his father died, and his father was a puppeteer, and he's a puppeteer. But his uncle ran off with the inheritance. So he's on his way to the New World to confront his uncle and get that back. But on his way there, they're attacked by pirates. And he ends up being pressed into service. And before you know it, he's captain. Captain Jack Shandy is the name that he goes by. Now, Jack Sparrow in the Pirates of the Caribbean movies, he's nothing like Jack Shandy. I mean, so you can't make that comparison. The comparison people are making is there's zombies and there's voodoo magic and there's sea battles and Fountain of Youth. And all these are elements of all those movies. So, but one of the things that I wanted to make sure I touched on is I really love how Tim Powers, not just in this book, but in other books, he is always looking at old stories and old books for inspiration for things. So at the very beginning of this novel, and I'll read a little bit, but at the very beginning, he starts to talk about the Odyssey, because the main character, not the main character, this is in the prologue, but a guy named Herwood needs to talk to a dead person. And that occurred in the Odyssey. And there was a certain series of events that happened in the Odyssey so that, Odysseus could do this, and they're following the same instructions. So I'm just going to read just a touch. It was only after they reached the clearing at the top of the hill that Herwood realized he'd all along been dreading it. There was nothing overtly sinister about the scene. A cleared patch of flattened dirt with a hut off to one side, and in the middle of the clearing, four poles holding up a small thatched roof over a wooden box. But Herwood knew that there were two drugged Arawak Indians in the hut, and an old oilcloth-lined 6-foot trench on the far side of the little shelter. The black man crossed to the sheltered box, the trone, or altar, and very carefully detached a few of the little statues from his belt and set them on it. He bowed, backed away, then straightened and turned to the other man, who had followed him to the center of the clearing. "You know what's next?" the black man asked, probably in a better accent than I just used. Herwood knew this was a test. "Sprinkle the rum and flour around the trench," he said, trying to sound confident. "No," said the Bokor. "Next, before that." There was definite suspicion in his voice now. "Oh, I know what you mean," said Herwood, stalling for time as his mind raced. "I thought that went without saying." What on earth did the man mean? Had Odysseus done anything first? No, nothing that got recorded anyway. But of course Odysseus had lived back when magic was easy and relatively uncorrupted. That must be it. A protective procedure must be necessary now with such conspicuous action to keep at bay any monsters that might be drawn to the agitation. You're referring to the shielding measures. Which consist of what? When strong magic still worked in the Eastern Hemisphere, what cards had been used? Pentagrams and circles? The marks on the ground. The black man nodded, mollified. "Yes," he said. But that's excuse me, that's what I love about Tim Powers so much. This is not my favorite of his books. My favorite of his books is called Declare. And I have not yet read all of his books, but my favorite of his books so far is called Declare. And Declare is a Cold War spy novel with magic and H.P. Lovecraft in it. And it is marvelous.
Wow, that's a combo.
Yeah, and it really is. But that's the kind of thing that he's always doing. I got to see him at a convention one time. And in a presentation he was giving, he said that his normal mode of coming up with a novel is history. He likes to look at history, and then he'll find something about a character in history or something odd that's occurred and something that has an explanation. But then he'll change the explanation. He'll say, well, that was, you know, magic did that, or this sinister reason. There's something happened that was even more odd than the actual explanation. And then from there, he builds his novel, just that one event. And he's done, you know, quite a few. So,
And this one has evil puppets. And the one I read had clowns, evil clowns.
I don't know about evil puppets. I guess, there's zombies and the Fountain of Youth. It's voodoo magic. There's a lot of voodoo magic in it. But yeah, the Anubis Gates was what? Coleridge, Samuel Taylor Coleridge. People went back in time to meet him. And Declare is, you know, the Cold War. And this book is the Caribbean, you know, in the 1700s. So anyway.
He just jumps all over.
He does, but it's cool.
It's cool.
I really enjoy it. And I have many more of his books to read, but I really enjoy him. I think that he's fantastic. And those are the reasons, but this book, again, it's not my absolute favorite of his, but I think it's fun. I think it's really good. And, but if you want to read one, you know, well, if pirates interest you, by all means read this one. You know, it's very good, but, I like Declare even better. So that's great. That one. Yep. And what's up for you next?
Well, this is a book of microfiction.
Microfiction?
Little tiny stories.
You have to read with a magnifying glass.
Yes. It's called Varieties of Disturbance by Lydia Davis. A friend of mine who I was in a group and read Infinite Jest with has been talking about Lydia Davis for like a year or so. And before that, I'd never heard of her.
And Infinite Jest sounds like the opposite of this book.
Yes, it is very much. the endless, endless tome. yeah, most of these stories, I mean, they kind of border almost on poetry because they're so short. In fact, one of the pieces I found on a poetry blog, because I went looking for it because I really liked it, called Head, Heart. And it's like 1, 2, 3, 4, about 8 or 9 lines. So the stories are varied. Some of them aren't quite that short. Some of them are written like faux sociological studies. For instance, there's one called We Miss You, a study of get well letters from a class of fourth graders. And it's taking the letters of fourth graders and analyzing them as if, you know, they're a unit and how they determine their class and gender and things like that. That's probably not my favorite part of the book, but there's one that has more footnotes than text, which of course makes me think of David Foster Wallace, who wrote Infinite Jest. My favorite one, I think, is Kafka Cooks Dinner, because it takes kind of the Kafka tone and applies it to a normal like date situation. I was going to read the very first paragraph of it, if you don't mind.
No, please do.
I am so filled with despair as the time grows near when she will come and I have not even begun to make a decision about what I will offer her. I'm so afraid I will fall back on the Kartoffel surprise, and it's no surprise to her anymore. I mustn't. I mustn't. I tell myself each morning that it will be different this time. I will plan the meal today, days ahead of time, but no. As though I am indeed my own enemy, the hours pass, and I thrust the thought away from me. Dinner, no, I will not think of it. Oh, such sickness. This is truly the sickness unto death. And the whole thing is like that.
Wow.
He starts even wondering if she even will show, and it's kind of entertaining because it's very Kafkaesque. You know how much I love that word. Hate the word.
It's your favorite word, right next to Thrum.
Oh, well, Thrum is fun, but Kafkaesque is overused. But in this particular instance, it applies. I don't know. You know, lately I've just been in the mood for short stories, and that doesn't always happen. I'm not sure why. Maybe I have a short attention span. But I've been enjoying going through a few books of them by different authors. And it's kind of a nice way to get to know an author you don't know really well, because you can see different facets of them all within one book. So in this case, which I had never read anything by her before, I felt like I saw a lot of sides of her.
Yeah, I agree with that.
So it was good.
Yeah, yeah. Tim Powers has a short story collection out too, and it occurs to me that that is a good way to sample him. He has a lot of really good stories in it. If I could remember the title.
I don't even know if she writes novels or not. She might be one of those people that only does short stories. I can't claim that for sure, though.
Right, right. Sorry.
So I guess that's all I really have to say about it.
Okay.
I don't know. It's just really enjoyable, though. There's a really disturbing fly on the cover. The way the cover is made, it looks like it's an actual fly, and the cover is kind of faded. So, but the fly is very vivid. You'll know it if you see it. It's very distinct.
Aha, that's it.
That's it.
Okay. The collection that I was thinking of is called The Bible Repairman and Other Stories by Tim Powers. Highly recommend that too.
Is there a clown in that one?
No, not that I remember. But there may as well be.
That's
No clowns. Yeah. Okay. Well, my next one is a little more philosophical, I guess. It's called Hamlet's Blackberry. Well, as you well know, you know, I've kind of had a tough month away, you know, doing a lot of work. And, you know, a lot of thinking comes along with that. Plus, you know, listening to NPR and stuff, you know, every now and then something comes across there that piques my interest. But one of the things that interests me constantly is, you know, how do people organize their lives and how do they live their lives better in the times that we're in? And, you know, that's a reason why, you know, I'd read like a planning book or, you know, the Stephen Covey stuff, you know, when we read something like that. But Hamlet's Blackberry is specifically about The Digital Age. It's the subtitle is A Practical Philosophy for Building a Good Life in the Digital Age. It was written in 2010, so it's already dated somewhat. But it's a really interesting attempt to take the time that we're in and the connectedness that we have and try to look at it in a way, you know, how do we best use it in our lives, or how do we best incorporate that into our lives? Is there too much of it? You know, is there a danger of too much? You know, and those kinds of questions. And some of the things that he talks about, this guy's last name happens to be Powers as well. His name is William Powers. No relation that I know of. I guess I was stuck in the P section of the library. But it's interesting, first of all, to see philosophers throughout history dealing with new technologies. And he touches on a lot of that. Like Socrates, for example, was not very enamored with the written word. He was thinking that that was a very, very bad idea. And in fact, I've got a quote from Socrates here. This is from the Dialogues of Plato. Phaedrus. He says, this discovery of yours, meaning writing and books, will create forgetfulness in the learner's souls, because they will not use their memories. They will trust to the external written characters and not remember of themselves. The specific which you have discovered is an aid not to memory, but to reminiscence. And you give your disciples not truth, but only the semblance of truth. They will be hearers of many things and will have learned nothing. They will appear to be omniscient and will generally know nothing. They will be tiresome company, having the show of wisdom without the reality.
You know what? No joke. We had this discussion at work today about Google.
No kidding. Isn't that seed? But that's
about how we don't remember anything anymore because we can just look it up.
Exactly. Exactly. And what does that mean for us? Yeah. And what does that mean for us? But isn't it interesting that Socrates was talking about the exact same thing? I just find that fascinating. And clearly we got through that revolution just fine, because I'm not sure how I could get by without the written word, even to untangle my knots, you know. A lot of things I do is write, and to figure things out, I'm always writing stuff, whether it be, you know, a letter to someone or a list of some type or whatever, or organization. And that makes you think, you know, with this flood of information that we have, I think that's what is frightening to everybody right now is, it's really two things. Okay. And the main thing I know is true, and this is what I've personally been feeling, is distraction destroys creativity. And I really believe that that's true. Like at work, for example, like during this last month, if I just take work as its own world and not think about anything else, right? Even at work, I'm in a constant state of interruption. You know, never mind the other things that I would like to do in my life, but I'm talking about just inside work. You know, people asking me questions, you know, doing this. And then whenever I get an hour alone, that is by far the most productive thing, right? Mm-hmm. So I know that that's true. And then if you extrapolate that through the rest of your life, if you're carrying your smartphone all the time and you respond to every text you receive or every email you receive and you let that interrupt you, then you're in a constant state of distraction. And I don't believe that that's healthy. At least I don't believe that that's healthy for myself.
Have you ever read The Shallows by Nicholas Carr?
No, I haven't.
Oh, it's an excellent book.
Okay.
About what we lose by not being able to focus anymore. I don't know. It's a really great book.
Okay, is that a nonfiction book? Or is it a novel? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He had also written an article, I think, for The New Yorker or something like that, that got a lot of press before his book came out. Mm-hmm. It's a few years old at this point. Yeah. But it was very much the same thing, kind of looking at how students struggle with deep reading, how no one reads anymore. Well, no one. We read. But how reading is kind of the opposite of that. Immersing yourself in a world and not being distracted by other things. It's kind of the antidote, I guess.
Yeah, and it is. This author even talks about that, which is funny because, you know, Socrates thought it was bad, and now he's holding that up as like, you know, maybe, you know, people worry about the book going away. You know, it's not really something to be concerned about because it still has a very important role to play. Mm-hmm. I saw an article, this is a sideline, but I saw an article the other day talking about how, you know, the very best stories that are being made now are on television. I still not quite there. I don't quite believe it. I still think the best of the novels beats the best of anything I've seen on TV.
Yeah.
Okay, so I said that there were two things. You know, the first thing being distraction. The second thing is the sheer volume of data that we take in a day. It's stunning, you know, compared to what Socrates was doing. You know, he'd have a few conversations during the day. But we, if we allow ourselves to be, are, you know, at a fire hose turned on all the way, all the time, especially, you know, my kids. That's just the way that they're taking in information, whether it be, you know, worthless information or important information. It's just blah, you know, and I think that might be it too. I heard a statement on the radio that made me think of you, but it also spoke to me because, you know, I've taken to using things like Evernote. Well, I say things like Evernote. I've taken to use Evernote as my own personal library in a way. And this person on the radio was talking about how the skills that are needed are almost the same as being your own personal librarian. You know, as kids come up, it's going to be a challenge of using the information that's out there and putting it somewhere or categorizing it somehow that makes sense to you. That's going to be an important skill.
Right.
And being able to, you know, Google the right way, you know what I mean? I mean, I've seen people that do that, you know, better than I do. And I'm like, oh, wow. Yeah, you find that. And I do it better than other people. So,
right. We're always hearing in my field, which, of course, I'm a librarian. Mm-hmm. We're always hearing how the profession is going to die. No one needs librarians anymore. Everything's on the internet. But actually, what we're finding is that in the past, where students didn't have the internet and there was one index to look in for their field for journals and things like that, students have so many options now. It's like we have to teach them how to narrow things down and how to evaluate what they're finding, because you can't just use the first thing you find. But finding the most reliable source or the best or the newest, it's a different set of skills.
Yeah, and wouldn't it be fascinating if the absolute opposite to the death of the librarian happened, and what happened was small groups of people need their own librarian, and now librarians become a super important, you know,
yes, I'm
even
available
more important
for this position.
There's going to be like librarians. Every 10 people has a librarian. Something like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, that really hit me because that's what I'm doing naturally is I'm trying to do that, right? Mm-hmm. You know, everything that I take in, you know, I take notes on all the books I read and I put them in here. And because, you know, and when I see an article that I'd like to read, sometimes I can't read it then. I just throw it in here. And then, you know, I've over the years, I've gotten a method of where I put stuff, and then sometimes I look through that and I read those things, and then I either delete them or file them. So, yeah, I just think that that's going to be an important skill. Mm-hmm. So some of the things that this guy has talked about, I actually should, you know, what does Hamlet's Blackberry have to do with any of it? I mean, what does Hamlet have to do with it, I guess, is the question. And
To
be or not to be.
Or not to be.
Okay, this is from the book, Hamlet's Blackberry, page 143. He's just describing some stuff in Hamlet. In Act 1, Hamlet meets the ghost of his dead father, whom everyone at this point believes was killed by a serpent's bite. The ghost has a newsflash. He wasn't done in by a snake, but poisoned by his brother, Hamlet's uncle Claudius, who is now the king. The ghost beseeches Hamlet to avenge this murder most foul, and bids him a spooky farewell. Adieu, adieu, Hamlet, remember me. Hamlet's reaction to all this is a bit surprising. Rather than focus on the ghost's staggering message, he reflects on his own state of mind and in particular his memory. He says, "Remember thee? Aye, thou poor ghost, while memory holds a seat in this distracted globe." The distracted globe he's talking about is his head. The actor playing Hamlet would have grasped his own while reciting the lines. Yes, he's saying, of course I'll remember you, because somewhere in this chaotic, unruly brain, I do still have a memory. Shakespeare also seems to be punning off two other meanings of globe. On one level, he's suggesting that the whole world is distracted, and on another, that the audience watching the play are in the Globe Theater. The Globe Theater might be having some mindfulness issues. Attention deficit disorder was apparently raging long before we gave it that inelegant name. Hamlet goes on. "Yea, from the table of my memory, I'll wipe away all trivial fond records, all saws of books, all forms, all pressures past, that youth and observation copied there, and thy commandment all alone shall live within the book and volume of my brain, unmixed with baser matter." So what he's basically saying is, I'm going to clean out all the mental clutter that makes me so distracted, so that the only thing that's taking up the space in my head will be you, the ghost, and this hideous crime. So that's where Hamlet's Blackberry comes from, or the title of the book. So I think it's a very worthwhile book. You know,
yeah,
there's a lot of things that are coming out now that are talking about that. I think that the word mindfulness over, you know, this was written in 2010. I'm starting to hear the word mindfulness all the time, and people talking about being present and this kind of thing. So it's kind of become a buzzword. The last thing I just wanted to mention about this was, you know, after he talks about all this stuff, there's a couple of chapters of suggestions. And in a chapter called Not So Busy, he kind of goes through some philosophers like Plato. There's just a short little section. It says the principle is distance. So Plato's principle as it applies to this is distance. So he's saying that if you're connected all the time, to step away from that connection every now and then makes the connection more valuable. Meaning that taking a day off, maybe once a week, I mean, just a suggestion, that if you took a day off once a week, that connection remains valuable and is less of a burden. Because you understand the value in that. And I can understand that thinking, you know, when I'm gone from home for work, one of the things that I've found is that you start to drop things off. Some of them you don't want to drop off. Some of them you very much don't want to drop off. But other things you're wondering, okay, well, why was that there anyway? And when you come back to the real world, maybe you don't add that back in. You know, so I think that the same thing is with connections. If you are constantly connected all the time, you know, maybe you on Sundays, or actually there's a chapter called an Internet Sabbath, which is a non-secular thing. He's just saying you declare one day a week in which you actually turn off your device and you don't use it. And that will help you keep it in perspective. So that's Plato is distance. Seneca is inner space. Gutenberg is technologies of inwardness. Shakespeare is old tools ease overload. Franklin is positive rituals. Thoreau is Walden zones. And there's someone named McLuhan called lower the inner thermostat. And that's the last one in there. So I just wanted to mention that. But again, I think it's a really worthwhile book. At least it's a nice beginning. You know, I don't think that that's all there is to say about this. And I haven't come to some specific conclusion where I can say, here, this is what I've come up with. You know, right. Maybe I'd write my own book at that point. But but I think it's a really worthwhile as a beginner to discuss it and to think about it in the terms of what makes my life better, and how to keep it from not making my life better, you know, because the internet's full of good and bad, obviously. I mean, what we're doing right now to me is one of the most valuable things in my life. You know, it's become, you know, reading books and talking about them on podcasts with you and with others is, I mean, I just absolutely love it. And I think it's very worthwhile. Yeah. But at the same time, I have probably wasted an hour or two on the internet doing things that are probably not very worthwhile.
Just an hour.
Just an hour, yeah. Just an hour or two over the last, 20 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, I would probably be horrified if I had someone present me with how much time I've spent doing silly things on the internet. Not that silly things are absolutely horrible. Some, you know, entertainment is okay. But I'm just saying that, you know, how many times, I'm sure everybody does it, but how many times have you sat down at 8 o'clock to check your email and now it's 11 and you're like, what the hell just happened?
Right. Like when I was in Oregon for 3 weeks and off the grid, which was rough,
yeah.
I would go to a coffee shop every once in a while and, you know, I didn't check my work email, but I would try to catch up just with my personal email, just the emails that mattered to me. But let's say I only had an hour.
Mm-hmm.
There's really only so much you can do in an hour.
Yeah.
And I would write 2 emails and then my time would be gone and I'd be like, ah. So I can't imagine how much time I
So I mean, yeah, that's interesting, you know, if you think about it that way, you know, what things did you choose to do in that hour? And all the other stuff that you do, is it worthwhile or not? You know, that's the kind of thoughts that I'm having at the moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, reading would stay.
Of course. Of course. For me too.
Because that was the one thing that was like my sanctuary.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Everything else, I don't need it as often. Yeah. However, the less time I spent on the internet, the more time I was seeking out people in person. You know, spend time with me.
Yeah. That's for sure. Well, and what would you be doing? What would you be doing otherwise? You know, that's another question too. It's like, right. You know, there's definite values. And even the guy who wrote the book, he's not a Luddite. He's not saying people shouldn't have smartphones, although smartphones do way more now than they did in 2010.
Yes. So, and there are no Blackberries anymore.
Exactly. Exactly. So yeah, he's not saying, you know, people should avoid these things. I mean, if he did, I wouldn't have enjoyed the book because, there definitely is a very positive effect that the internet and the devices have had on my life, but they've also had a negative effect. So it's just a matter of thinking
about it. Just like people had to learn how to use books properly.
Right, right.
And writing properly, then mm-hmm. people need to own how they use everything else.
Exactly right.
If it's another stage in all of that evolution.
Yeah. So if anybody's listening here who has any other books kind of along the same vein, I would actually really love to hear about that. So please write in or leave a comment. Because I would keep reading them. Yeah. So what have you got last?
Well, it's funny because I feel like the book I picked for my last pick is kind of a progression of this.
Really?
It's Crux by Ramez Nam. It's actually the second book in a series or trilogy. I'm not sure which.
Mm-hmm.
So I have this, I have certain subgenres of science fiction that I really like. One of them is post-apocalyptic and dystopian. The other, that's kind of a newer fascination, is this idea of post-humans.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what humans become after they evolve into something greater than they are. And I mean, I guess that we could continue in a life of turning off our smartphones and collecting things in Evernote and hiring personal librarians. But what if there was a drug that would let you connect to other people's brains, or to learn at a higher pace, or to break into someone's brain and control them? Oh, wait, that's not so good. but that's kind of what this book is about. There's this drug that's been distributed called Nexus 5, and it allows for all of those things. And it's an open source drug, so people can get into the code and manipulate it to do other things. Some things are good and some things are bad. There's Some people that are using it for pleasure. Like there's this club where the DJ, everyone can hook into the DJ's mind and it makes the music a shared experience instead of just an individual one. That's mm-hmm. kind of neat. Mm-hmm. There's this group of kids who were able to learn on their own and then share what they're learning and what they're struggling with. And so they all learn better. But really it's kind of like, an adventure action type crime novel. It's very fast paced, because the guy who developed Nexus is trying to find the people who are using it for evil and to stop them. And then also to, you know, stop them through the code, but also stop them in person. Mm-hmm. And so then of course there's two groups of people, the people who have Nexus in their systems and the people that don't. And so governments are preventing people from having it who have it to be around certain situations. Like one of them, his brain was hacked and he tried to kill the president. So, you know, obviously a danger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I don't know. I've read a good handful of books with this kind of topic. And it always kind of comes down to the societal and ethical ramifications of people evolving beyond other people. Being smarter, more talented, have more access to things.
Not needing sleep.
Right, not needing sleep. I've definitely read a few books and stories that have that as the premise. Mm-hmm. Aging slower or faster, depending. Learning faster. All those things. I'm mm-hmm. fascinated by this topic. And it's funny because, I mean, it's kind of presented science fiction, you know, unreal. But the author, Ramez Nam, is a scientist. And so at the very end of the book, he tells you all of the research that shows how close they are to doing things like this, which, of course, makes the whole thing better. I think it's really fascinating. And he's actually written books on that topic in, you know, nonfiction. I'm going to have to look it up here. He was an engineer for Microsoft for 15 years, and he's done programming and stuff like that. Let's see. Oh, his book, More Than Human, Embracing the Promise of Biological Enhancement. That was published in 2005. So I guess after that, he started writing novels about it. Because sometimes novels are, you know, easier to understand concepts like that in.
More Than Human is a famous science fiction novel by Theodore Sturgeon.
Right. So he uses the same title.
Yeah, that's cool.
I'm sure that's on purpose.
Yeah, I'm sure it is too. So, yeah, biological enhancements, that's something. Hmm. But yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and the reason I read this book, I'd read the previous one before and really liked it. But he's one of the nominees for the John W. Campbell Award, which is part of, you know, the Hugo list, which is coming up pretty soon here.
Yeah.
So I wanted to make sure I read it before then.
Mm-hmm.
But let's see, other books that are kind of along this line, the Nancy Kress novels.
Beggars in Spain was the first one, and all those.
I don't know. I'd have to. I could come up.
Yeah,
I mean, with a list.
Yeah, there are so many, and
there are a lot of
things
them,
like you know, when you transfer your consciousness into a robot, when you can afford that and other people can't.
Right. You know, I guess inequality. Robots would be the next progression after this.
Yeah.
So. Before I left for my trip, I got a chance to use Google Glass.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. And so I had started this book, and it was funny how much of an impact it had on me. I'd kind of blown it off a little bit. Mm-hmm. But I was thinking, well, what if I could hook into the internet without having to take out a device? And I don't mean wearing the glasses. I mean, what if it were imprinted into my brain somehow, or programmed or added or dumped in there?
Mm-hmm.
What if I could scroll through other people's ideas alongside my own? What would happen? Could my brain process that in a different way? Could my brain work as a search engine, for instance, or, you know, could it file things away? I'm really curious about that. One of my former students, he has cochlear implants that allow him access to his voicemail and his music. And he can just, you know, listen to things through Bluetooth. So I don't know. It feels kind of closer than it used to. And I think that's why a book like this is so exciting, because you can almost see it happening.
Mm-hmm.
Almost.
Almost, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's going to be interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That kind of stuff, and then the 3D printer, I think, are going to change the world. I mean, that's going to be drones. Something else. Yeah. Well, drones, yeah. Yeah. Drones negatively so. The other ones have potential to be positive, but there's always going to be negative.
Well, drones can be used positively, too.
To bring your books?
Well, some of the faculty where I work, they did a study on lighting in poor neighborhoods to try to make the argument that whether or not light was there made an issue or made a difference in crime. Mm-hmm. And they were able to go into the neighborhood without being, you know, putting anyone in danger.
Yeah.
So that's positive. And real estate. My friend buying a house said that those that have drone tours seem more appealing than houses just with photographs. I don't know. Drones are scarier.
Drones are scary. Yeah. I think once we start to make machines that can pull the trigger.
Yeah.
I think that's something we're never going to come back from.
But 3D printers can make weapons.
Yes, they can. Yes, they can.
That's or they saying. Can make completely spherical chocolate shells. Make chocolate, not war.
Make chocolate guns. Yep. Yeah, that's going to be some kind of an amazing thing, man, when you can just print whatever you want.
It's really neat.
Yep. That's going to be something else. I still don't know how that's going to fit. I know every economist is like, how on earth are we going to survive that? But it'll be interesting.
Mm-hmm. I just started thinking about all the things I could make. I'm going to go make myself a car.
I saw a thing on Twitter the other day that said, once a 3D printer can print a 3D printer, we are screwed.
I think that's when it becomes self-aware, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, shoot. Well, this was fun as always.
Yes.
So thank you very much.
Yes, I'm looking forward to our new schedule.
Yes, yes. So we'll thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll we'll be back in 2 weeks. So every other Tuesday, right? Every other Tuesday.
Yep. All right. Absolutely.
Cool. Well, take care, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you for listening to the Reading Envy podcast. You can find us at readingenvy.com.